So our first speaker is Jenny Higgins, who is an assistant professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She researches and writes about pleasure, sexuality, and the prevention of unintended pregnancy and STIs, including HIV/AIDS.
Good morning. So I am at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but I recently left Columbia School of Public Health, where I continue to work with my collaborators there on this project. And I see some Columbia folks in the room. It's always nice to see them. So I don't need to this room say anything about the fact that HIV transmission continues to be a concern in sub-Saharan Africa, and also that we need to know more about the contextual factors influencing HIV. So particularly in this region of sub-Saharan Africa, we have tremendous epidemiologic data, lots and lots of data on risk factors. Understanding risk factors alone doesn't help us understand how they actually fit into the shape of people's lives, and so qualitative research is really terrific at contextualizing such variables. On the other hand, even though I'm primarily a qualitative researcher, I really think that quantitative studies have done a number of things extremely well with HIV-related research, and I'm trying to learn some lessons from them and figure out how to bridge the gap. So for example, few qualitative studies have actually used data from newly infected HIV youth, and very few qualitative studies have compared newly positive and newly negative peers, and I'll talk about the advantages in doing so. So we're still in the middle of this larger study. It's 5 years. It's 15 to 24-year-olds in Rakai, Uganda, which is southwest Uganda, close to the Tanzania border. And the study involves both quantitative and qualitative components. So at the quantitative level, there's been this historical community cohort study going on that's really phenomenal. So we're working with data from about 15,000 young adults. So people from the Rakai Health Services Program go into the field, not only conduct surveys, but collect blood specimens from survey participants. So we have serostatus data and other biomarkers. And then the part of the study I've run is the qualitative life history interviews with 60 young adults. And half of the sample consists of HIV-positive people, half of HIV-negative, and then we have a mix of gender and marital strata, since we know that gender and marital strata are so important in shaping HIV, particularly in this region. All right, so I'm going to put my teacher hat on for a moment. So those of you who took EPI in public health school remember that one of the primary methodological tools of epidemiologists is to take someone with a disease condition and take someone without the disease condition and compare the two, if you can control for things like age, for example, and try to explore the factors that might explain why one person has the disease and one person doesn't, when holding constant other factors. So what we've tried to do here in this study is actually a qualitative or an ethnographic version of that. So using this community cohort data I told you about, we were able to identify people who had contracted HIV in the last year. Sometimes these young people actually didn't know that they were HIV positive. They hadn't necessarily gone back and gotten their test results. But we used this biomarker data to locate, essentially, every HIV incidence case among this age group in the last year in this region. Then we went and found negative matches for these HIV-positive respondents according to gender, according to community, marital status, and age group. So essentially what we were trying to do is holding constant some factors that influence HIV transmission, what helps explain why some people are getting HIV and some people are not. The reason I've bolded the 20 to 24 age group is because the good news in this area, incidence is decreasing among the youngest adolescents. So we actually only located a very few cases of people in the younger age group. So I think we have two or three 19-year-olds, but almost all of our respondents are between the ages of 20 and 24. And methodologically, I'm very interested in this. So the unit of analysis becomes the pair. I've done qualitative research for years where the unit of analysis is the individual. So I read the transcript from the individual person and compare that with others. But here, the pair itself is the unit of analysis. Let me show you an example of this. So this is an example of previously married men. And you look here, what we've done is essentially sort of put various aspects of the interview together. So you can see that both men dropped out of school, didn't have money for school fees. Both men have a child. Both men work as moto drivers. The negative respondent is a peanut farmer, once an agricultural church, so very similar. Neither man used condoms regularly, so similar condom use patterns. Similar testing history and practices. Both men had been tested recently, but the negative respondent had picked up his result. But in terms of relationships and partners, the negative respondent has had one partner in the last year, reported her status to be negative, but I decided to find one partner and be faithful to her. Where the positive respondent had three partners in the last year, he had only had one partner currently, but only because he didn't have money to afford other partners, and he had not discussed HIV status. So what you see is we essentially take two people, lay them out side by side, and see what pops out to us as a difference. So the content of the interviews, we covered four main topics over two interviews: key life events and goals, pregnancy and parenthood, HIV and reproductive health knowledge and attitude, and sexual relationships. And I say we did this over two interviews, so hopefully by the second interview, the respondents felt more comfortable with us and were able to share different and more intimate data. So let me share some results with you. So we were surprised to find extremely few differences between the HIV respondents and their pairs, except for in their sexual relationship status. So with all three other areas of the interview guide, actually, there was very, very little difference. So for example, my colleague John Santelli is very interested in things like developmental trajectories and whether life goals and aspirations may be protective against HIV. In this case, both negative and positive respondents had lots of life goals and aspirations. Both had been truncated. You know, often they had experienced same levels of truncation due to resource scarcity. But the major difference that emerged was relationship status. And what I want to do is spend the rest of my time talking about a few of the themes related to relationship status. Oh, and I just wanted to draw attention to my colleague, Sanyuk DeMather, who was originally on this panel, but who is late in her own pregnancy, and so didn't end up coming. So what she has explored is there are differences in parenthood plans between HIV-positive and HIV-negative youth, and that makes a lot of sense, right? If you contract HIV, your own future of childbearing might change. But what I'm exploring is factors that help explain transmission. So, as I've said, relationship dynamics emerged as the most salient theme exploring these differences. And forgive me, the animation on this slide is a little wonky. But there are three sub-themes: communication, mistrust and suspicion, and type and number of partnerships. Because I'm a qualitative researcher, I want to emphasize how interconnected these are. So it's extremely rare to find one of these themes among a respondent and not the others. But I'll want to present them to you separately so that you can understand each sub-theme. So let's start with communication. What I'm going to do is give you an overview of each sub-theme, talk about any differences by gender, and then give an example. So in terms of communication, compared to HIV-positive respondents, HIV-negative respondents were much more likely to report speaking to their partners about a number of issues, right? So in public health, we tend to only ask about HIV communication or family planning communication, but actually, these couples tended to speak about all sorts of other issues, like, you know, in terms of how many children would you like, or what are your sort of life goals? And HIV prevention and pregnancy prevention were part of that. This was true both during courtship and at later relationship stages. And as a result, HIV-positive respondents were just less likely to know their partner's serostatus because they had not communicated about these things. And there were some differences by gender, even though we saw the differences by serostatus across all genders. Compared to HIV-positive men, HIV-positive women were more likely to describe their partner's unwillingness to test, right, due to gender power imbalances. So young women would say, I repeatedly asked him to go get tested, and he refused. Comparatively, HIV-positive men were more likely to just not know their partner's status versus having asked for test results and been refused. So both HIV-positive men and women reported fewer HIV-related discussions, but they took different forms. Here's an example. This is a pair of previously married women. So the HIV-positive respondent talked about a very difficult relationship. My husband cautioned me to never participate in RECHI project activities. He told me I should never test for HIV with RECHI. When he told me so, I asked myself why. He's refused me. This showed me that he is the one who infected me with the virus. So they did not communicate around HIV in a way that pleased her. And at the time of the interview, even though she knew she had contracted HIV, she had not told her partner, which it was, again, a sort of another indication of the level or the lack of communication in their relationship. In contrast, the HIV match in this pair had tested for HIV with her ex-husband and had shared results. So again, you can see the negative match makes the HIV positive pair pop. In terms of mistrust and suspicion, compared to HIV positive respondents, HIV negative respondents expect greater trust when describing their relationships. And this is certainly not a new finding. This was true with both primary and secondary partners. HIV respondents often reported assurance that main partners did not have other sexual partners. So regardless of the reality, there tended to be a real visceral sort of sense of assurance and confidence about this among the negative respondents. And HIV respondents were much more likely to express suspicion, not only about partners' movements, which is the term for sort of extra partner activities, or their histories in general. So for example, one positive man talked about getting married and finding out only after he'd gotten married that his wife had had children from a prior part of her life. So gender influences here, compared to HIV-positive men, HIV-positive women were especially likely to express mistrust about partners' other partners. So even though women also had outside partners, men were more likely to, which I'll talk about in a moment. So sexual opportunity structures in general afforded men more access to multiple partners, so women's suspicions were well-founded here in some ways, but they tended to be more concentrated among the HIV-positive women. Men were more likely to report general suspicion about partners' past or work-related activities, whether they had children, things like medication. So, for example, one HIV-positive man talked about a partner he'd had in the last year, and he noticed that she had medication in her room, and he suspected that it was AZT treatment, but he never asked her, and she never said anything about it. So he suspected she was HIV-positive, but he didn't know. An example here of a pair of married men, the HIV respondent said, I separated from one of my partners because I did not trust her and I suspected she might be HIV positive. And the match in comparison said, I'm not concerned about HIV because I trust my wife. The final theme I want to present is partnership type and number. And of course, this also is not new. Partnership type is consistently correlated with higher HIV risk, and we certainly found this in the quantitative data as well. What I like to emphasize here is it's not just number of partnerships that matters, it's the type and quality of the partnership as well. So compared to HIV negative respondents, positive respondents reported slightly more lifetime and current partners, and also their partners appeared to have greater number of partners, so larger sexual networks. But also the quality of the relationship differed in that HIV respondents were more likely to report shorter term partners with less. They just didn't know them. They were just traveling through, or they knew they lived. The person lived in another town, but they didn't know much more else about the partner. In terms of gender, although I want to say that men did tend to report a larger overall number of partners in the last year, a lot of women reported outside partners as well, and for the most part, there were very similar patterns by gender. And the example I'll give here is a pair of married men, where the HIV-positive respondent reported two partners in addition to his wife. But when he was reflecting on his partner's partners, he suspected one of these had up to six other partners. One of these partners of this, so we're looking sort of at the third circle out, he said one of them had deteriorated in the last year and he thought perhaps due to HIV/AIDS. The HIV respondent in this match reported one partner in addition to his wife, so it's not as if he was totally monogamous, but he reported regular condom use with his outside partner, and this partner lived in his same village, and so he seemed to have more knowledge of that person's sexual networks. I'm going to, just in the interest of time, just only present one case study to show you again how these things are intertwined. So this is a busy slide. Let me walk you through it. This is a pair of previously married women. At first glance, these respondents are actually very, very similar, right? They're 23 or 24. They both have two children. If you look at that third bullet point, both had hoped to become a nurse, but both had to drop out of school due to lack of school fees. Both had married early. The negative respondent actually experienced abuse during that marriage. But then when you start to look at their partnerships and their relationship context, not only did the negative respondent have fewer partners, but they had discussed contraception together, and they had experienced couple-based testing. In contrast, the HIV-positive respondent knew less about her partners. She had not discussed or tested with her partners, and she was using family planning injections covertly, which seems like a really good proxy for poor communication or trust in the relationship in other ways. Let me move to conclusions. So I'll just say again that the differences in these life history interviews between the respondents pertain very largely to relationship dynamics. But again, just because I'm a contextual researcher, I want to emphasize relationship dynamics are also a proxy for other underlying factors like resource scarcity and gender power imbalances. And I want to emphasize that I think dyadic approaches to HIV transmission are critical. This research is just another, for me, sort of log in the fire indicating that individual level interventions are just not the way to go with HIV, because if we're only working with one member of the couple here, how could that person overcome the mistrust and other aspects in the relationship? So couples-based programs such as testing programs may be warranted, but of course the research suggests that the people who would be even willing to consider couples-based testing are already in a better situation in terms of their dynamics. So this stuff cannot happen without attendant reductions in, I think, resource scarcity and gender power imbalances. And just as a methodological contribution, I think this study shows that there's really great utility in combining qualitative methods with this epidemiologic framework. I really like using pairs as the unit of analysis, and it's opened up some qualitative possibilities for me as a researcher. And just I'll end with sort of mentioning some of the pros and cons of this method. I think the main advantage is that when I'm looking at the pair, the main differences pop in a different way than if I'm only looking at individuals. And also, the pairs make the data seem more manageable. Those of you who do qual research can understand how unwieldy the data can feel, and this somehow makes it slightly more manageable. The disadvantage is that we might, in each pair, be looking so strongly for differences that we're projecting them when they don't exist, right? Because we're so desperate to sort of find the explanation behind why one person contracted HIV. And of course, because these data are cross-sectional, we're limited in our ability to detect underlying causes of relationship dynamics. But in general, I really have liked this methodological approach, and I'll use it again. I want to thank the R01 we're working with, and John Santelli, my colleague in PI, and then our larger New York and Rakai-based teams. Thanks very much.